Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. A recent study showed that the average human attention span is about 8 seconds. That means our average length of concentration on one detail is less than that of a goldfish. Yes, you heard that right. Goldfish can concentrate for 9 whole seconds. We humans for only 8. Well, if that doesn't alarm you, it at least explains why we seem to be working harder than ever, longer hours than ever, yet seem to accomplish less and feel less fulfilled. Joe Lowitzo and Elazar Aslan join me today to reveal how we can turn that around. In their new book, Boundless Leadership, they share the 5 truths, the 4 qualities of heart, and they discuss how we can reimagine and rewire our mind and body to be our best selves. Now, let me tell you a little bit about my guests who co-authored Boundless Leadership. Joe Lowitzo is a contemplative psychotherapist, a clinical researcher, and Buddhist scholar teacher. He's on the faculty at the Weill Cornell Medical College and the Columbia University Center for Buddhist Studies, where he lectures widely on the role of meditative learning in the future of health, education, and leadership. Elazar Aslan is an executive advisor, speaker, and entrepreneur. After a successful career as a business executive, he became a professional coach over a decade ago, bringing his meditative practice and leadership principles to corporations such as Chase, D&B, MasterCard, American Express, and more. So let me bring my guests on now. Again, Joe Lowitzo and Elazar Aslan, and the book is called Boundless Leadership: The Breakthrough Method to Realize Your Vision, Empower Others, and Ignite Positive Change. Joe Lowitzo and Elazar Aslan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here.
I'm glad to have both of you here and looking forward to talking about this book because it's called Boundless Leadership, as I said in the intro. And you say it all begins with self-leadership. And I so believe in that, but there are so few books around that really address that self-leadership aspect. So lots to talk about here. I wanted to begin with a fun fact, and maybe Elazar, you can speak to this. A recent study revealed that the average human attention span is about 8 seconds, which means we now have a shorter attention span than a goldfish. It's kind of alarming.
Yes. We went from being better than monkeys to being worse than goldfish, at least in attention span.
Right.
And you could understand that from a personal experience, how much more stressed we are, how much more we have to do, how so many of us believe that the only way we would handle our workload is by multitasking, doing more and more. And, of course, that wears down our ability to stay focused and concentrate on a single object.
Right. And isn't it true, Joe, that studies have shown time after time that multitasking is ineffective?
Absolutely. We just can't do anything as well if we're in the middle of doing more than one thing. We have a finite attention span, finite neural and cognitive capacities, and if we stretch them, they're going to be weaker at any one point.
Right. Going back to the book title here, Boundless Leadership, Elazar, I wonder if you can just tell us how you came up with that title and why you felt now was the right time to write this book.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, Joe and I have been collaborating on this topic for the past 10 years. We do workshops and programs behind this, and we came to the conclusion that we could only reach so many people with this information. And as we have these programs and we see the shift that people make, and they're always looking to have more and have more people do it, so we decided that a book would be a better way to reach more people. And it's especially important these days when it's hard not to be stressed, you know, with climate change and the political situation and pandemics and remote working, on and on. So it's really a good time to figure out how to bring the stress down, how to be more impactful, and how to have more ease as we do it. Regarding the title of Self-Boundless Leadership, of course, we played with a few, but at the end of the day, this is a very apt title, because when we are at our best, when we are absent of the limitations and the confused thinking that we have for ourselves, many of us do, we actually, in our own nature, are boundless. When the limitations are gone, we could really accomplish most anything. When we're living from our potential, we are boundless.
Mm. Right, and I hear a lot of people feeling frustrated now, people that I've talked with, feeling frustrated that they're not reaching that potential right now. Are you hearing the same thing, Alizar?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so glad you bring that up. I mean, one of the most important tenets of the book is that our limitations or our confused thinking, most of us turn that into thinking that there's something wrong with us individually, that we have these defects, weaknesses, things that we don't want anybody to know. But the reality is that this is all a result of the human condition, and some of it goes through our evolution, some of it is genetic, and a lot of it is the normal conditioning that we all have. So just even beginning with the idea that, oh, it's not me, it's us, and then adding the point that there's a way out should relieve a lot of that frustration.
Right, right. And that kind of leads into what I wanted to talk about a little here is the great resignation. So some people call it the big quit, but it's happening worldwide, but it's happening in America at an alarming rate. I mean, all of my relatives overseas are going, what the heck is going on? So, Joe, I'm wondering what you're hearing, and, you know, presumably people are looking at their life pre-pandemic and during the pandemic and just wanting to do something different.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is a kind of worst-case scenario of the chronic cumulative increase or ratcheting up of stress and overwhelm that has been going on for decades as we've been moving more into the digital lives and economy and marketplace. But specifically, the pandemic has really created a very, very, sort of focusing or galvanizing effect here because, you know, while we may or may not realize it, the idea of really being, you know, on remotely, it creates both extra stress because we're not, our brains didn't evolve to manage the kind of virtual connections that are required of a remote work, and also the extra social isolation, which just makes us feel much more dissatisfied, deprived or a little bit sort of unsupported or disconnected. And so those factors have, you know, compounded a already low level of engagement that most, you know, workers or leaders or people have in their workplace, given that the way we work is basically, you know, not sustainable, right?
Right.
So basically, it's a kind of perfect storm where there's been something wrong for years. Now it's sort of ratcheted up in this new situation, and people are taking advantage because, you know, they feel more, you know, on their own. And some of that is great because sometimes people are thinking, well, could I have more satisfaction or more of a sense of well-being living another way, doing something different? Some of it is really just, you know, cumulative stress speaking and an expression of burnout.
Right, right. I see a lot with people. Some people I know are dying to get back in the office, but I have to say a lot are not. I've worked remotely for 20 years, and it's even done my head in a bit because normally we'd be going out socializing, and, you know, you kind of make up for that alone time then. So let's jump into the book here. And Alizar, you write that Joe and I do not see leadership as an executive position of power or a set of skills honed to influence others. We see it as a way of being. You didn't always see it that way. So tell us about how you came to this place of seeing leadership as a way of being.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm classically trained in business, got an MBA, went the corporate route, climbed the ranks as an executive, and there is a very strong culture there that basically says, you know, you're as good as your last decision, that leadership is about power and authority and titles. And a good leader is somebody who has a sharp mind, can make good decisions, is analytical. So it created two big mistakes. One is the definition of leadership being one of force, being one of title, being one that you get as opposed to one you earn. And leadership was seen based on your decision-making having very little to do with your interaction with others, with your relationship, with engagement, with connectivity. That's just something that people had to do because they work for you. And, you know, we see today more than before that, no, employees are your number one asset, but also engagement comes from human factors like recognition, appreciation, seeing them for who they are, not about the money and not about the title. We're kind of accustomed to think it's that, so it's, there's some vestiges of that. But every survey just proves that wrong. So this idea that leadership is A, not about your power over others, but your influence over others, and B, that that leader is a whole human being. So it's not just about the mind. It's the heart of the leader and the body of the leader, which is why in the book we break it very specifically into those three disciplines. So those two things have really been a wake-up call. Fortunately for me, it happened earlier in my career, and for many of my clients, it tends to happen later. But more and more of us are waking up to that.
Yes, and I wish more people would. I've talked with Donald Altman, ex-Zen monk, and other people like him who go, and I know you do this too, who go into companies and teach meditation and things like that. And I wish more companies would adopt that. Moving on from Elazar's answer, Joe, you describe leadership as the timeless art of fostering the best in oneself and others. And you say that the enlightenment in leadership, fortunately, has come just in time to show us all a way out of the dead end of scarcity, the us versus them thinking. And you talk about this a lot throughout the book, us versus them. So just give us a high level overview, please, if you would, Joe, of what you mean by the scarcity thinking.
Right. That's just the way that we've been conditioned, at least for, you know, for centuries, if not for, you know, millennia, of thinking of success, well-being, safety, comfort, all the good things in life as scarce resources we have to compete for. It only a few people get. And I think this, you know, sort of been baked into our whole view of the world since, you know, what we call social Darwinism, which evolved around the same time as modern economics, right? This notion that only a few people are going to get the fruits of the system, and that's just the way it has to be because it just isn't enough to go around. And what we've discovered in terms of happiness and well-being in the last two decades or so is that actually, you know, we don't actually need to get, you know, this you know, past a certain level of comfort and safety in terms of financial success. Happiness and well-being are not really don't increase, you know, directly in response to how much more, you know, material success or status or power you get. And in fact, what they increase is as a result of our connectivity with others, as Elazar was talking about. That's what really promotes well-being. That's what really promotes, you know, a lasting sense of happiness, creativity. And of course, the idea here is that, you know, if we run a system by sort of, you know, scaring or you know, exploiting or trying to get the most out of most people so that a few can really rise to the top, then we're setting it up in a really self-defeating way. Because the way, you know, success, wealth, and happiness is created is through many minds working and hearts working together on a common goal. And the sort of the whole mindset of it's me against, you know, you, or it's us against them, it really sets us into an alienated stress mode that actually really creates tremendous suffering and mind-body stress and wear and tear. So what we're really talking about is getting out of that the stress psychology, which makes us think that we need to fight to flourish or thrive, and moving into a new whole approach to life, which is really reflected in many, many scientific and other disciplines now, that really well-being for humans is about working together, connecting in a more sort of horizontal way with you know, elevating more and more people, you know, to have the capacity to really co-create in a you know, a sort of truly collegial way.
Yeah. You know, I was working last year with a group that, you know, everybody worked really hard. There were some really smart people with on that team. Everybody was doing their best, but it was the most joyless experience I've had in a long time. I was only there for a couple of months, thank you, as a consultant, but I just thought I couldn't imagine going into that every day. It's almost like there's a fear to feel joy at work or to express it or to experience it. And I know your book is all about this. It's all about surviving versus thriving. So I want to talk a little bit about the practice, because you talk a lot about the new science and then blending this with older science, if you will, and new business practices. Elazar, what are you seeing? Let me rephrase this. How is your book different to many of the other business books out there? And I think we've touched on a little of that already, but what would you like to say about your book being different to others on the shelves out there?
Yeah, aside from the leadership being an inside job approach, the other thing that's very different about it, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the book is based on a program. The program that we've developed, its intention is for change and transformation. So the book is not about downloading information. I mean, it can do that, but that's not our motivation. Our motivation is to have in your hands something that you can walk through and make changes on a daily basis in your life so that you can get to a better outcome. So that's its purpose. Now, the other thing that we do to achieve that purpose is that it's very structured. We talk a big game about the change in your life and in your leadership and the impact on the world you can have. But in order to get there is really what it's all about. So we create a very methodical approach. First, we break it down into the three disciplines of mind, heart, and body. And therefore, if any one of these, much less all three of them, you're at your optimal with each, then you're going to be really a boundless leader. But how do you become, how do you have the optimal mind and the optimal heart and body? We break it down. For each one of these disciplines, there is a trait. And a trait is something you develop over time. So there's a competency that you could work on. For example, under the mind, it's a trait of self-awareness. And it's the competency of clarity. But even having clarity of mind is an effort. That's not how we're conditioned. So we break it down to its four qualities. And each quality then gets a very precise practice that you do to cultivate that quality. So now you have things you can do for each quality which is accessible, and over time these four qualities give you the competency, and you have then this trait, and you are at your optimal self for mind, heart, and body. And as you do that for each of the three disciplines, then it's very accessible, even though it's comprehensive and rather massive, it is achievable because it's broken down bit by bit.
Right. And although you don't have to do it in order per se, it really, every practice builds upon itself, really, I think. That's my experience from going through the book. So let's talk a little bit more about leadership as an inside job. You write in the book that we hear a lot about the brain, about neural connections and neuroplasticity, but we don't talk much about the mind, Joe. So why is that? And it's true, because I've read many books on this topic, and it's true.
Right. I think this is part of our whole modern approach to reduce things to the least common denominator, the most material elements. But the reality is that although it's very intangible and hard to put your finger on, we discovered in recent decades that the mind has a very powerful impact on the nervous system, on the brain functioning, and on the whole body. And so this kind of mind-body effect is part of what we're trying. It's the mechanism by which the brain changes happen. We put the emphasis on the brain changes because that makes us feel like it's real, or we can sort of see what the impact is. But the impact isn't achieved by knowing a lot about your brain. It's achieved by working with your attention, your awareness, your experience. And that's an element of psychology that our culture is actually having to learn from ancient traditions that have developed mind training practices over the centuries. And now that we're seeing that these ways of training our attention, our emotional capacity, even our embodied energies, our way of energizing or being in our body, these methodologies turn out to be very impactful and effective in the lab, we really have a reason to believe that if we really rigorously use some of these practices, we can gradually have the kind of transformational effect that Ozar's talking about. So it's really about the difference between a great, you know, promise, hey, you can change your brain, to the how. How can you do it? What do you have to do? And that involves training your mind.
Right. And since you're a psychiatrist, Joe, I'll ask this of you. Why do so many people who think they are, who are not at all self-aware, think they are self-aware? What stops us seeing our own lack of self-awareness?
Well, I mean, I think some of it is, and I can say this as a physician, right? Some of it is the way we're acculturated or trained to project confidence and knowledge, right? So a lot of times we just, you know, by default, we sort of gloss over like the obvious fact that we have blind spots or biases or limitations because we want to put our best foot forward, and that's projecting a kind of confidence. Unfortunately, this often happens to kind of actually get in our way because we miss the way in which just we may know a lot, we may be super smart and super capable, but we're just one human being, and we don't understand necessarily where other people are that we need to work with, and we don't necessarily understand what our internal limits, blind spots, or conditions are. And that's where the deeper self-awareness is not just kind of knowing what we think we know about ourselves, but it's being engaged in a journey of discovering empirically, like, you know, questioning moment to moment or observing moment to moment through having a method of seeing into ourselves deeply, right? So it's a difference between, again, like having a description of an experiment or you know, a hypothesis that you test versus actually testing it.
Okay.
I think I know I'm aware, but you find out when you start to pay attention to yourself that there's all kinds of stuff going on inside of you that you didn't really know was there.
Right, right. And while we're talking about the mind, I want to talk a little bit about balance, Lazar. You write in the book that often when we talk about balance, we're talking about the balance between personal life and work. But you're really talking about the balance of our mind to help reduce that stress that we feel.
Yes. When I work with my clients, most of their issues that we discuss are things that happen when they're off balance, off center, you know. So their ability to assess, their ability to know what is a response and what is a reaction, you know, their ability to have resilience, all of those things suffer when you're not balanced, when you're off center. The actual metaphor I use with my clients is, are you on the horse or are you off the horse? Are you riding the horse, or is the horse riding you? So if you're not sitting balanced on that horse and you're falling off, you're just going to be much less effective. Mm. Getting that balance of mind is critical.
Right, right. I want to talk about how fatigue plays into that, because there's a fascinating study you talk about in the book, Lazar, that talks about fatigue and how a study was done at Columbia University on judges, and fatigue played into their decision-making. It was quite shocking, really.
Yes, it is. You know, regardless of our positions, we are all human, first and foremost. So we are susceptible to all those things that affect any human being, and one of them is fatigue. We talk about fatigue as one of the five obstacles to having clarity of mind. And it's just been shown that as our mind, as we get more and more tired, our ability to think well, again, to respond, not react, to resist temptation, all those things are affected. With the judges that you were referring to, you know, as you know, they started finding more people guilty towards the end of their day because of fatigue. So it really affects how we think. It affects our resilience, which is why, thankfully, you know, when I was in my young days of business, we were warriors because we didn't sleep. Oh, I pulled an all-nighter. Oh, I slept for
right.
hours. And we were proud of it. And thank God that's changing. And now people say, no, no, I am a human being and I need my best. And that includes sleep. It
right.
includes less stress. It includes better nutrition. I need to be at my best mind, heart, and body.
It's changing very slowly, though, isn't it, really? Because, you know, I just look at people I know and people I work with and even myself. I try to be aware of that kind of stuff. But people do get hooked into this busy, and, you know, certain companies certainly put pressure on people. They really don't care if you work an all-nighter.
Right, right. It is, on the one hand, changing slowly, but on the other hand, it's really only come to our awareness as an issue fairly recently. So it will most likely or hopefully follow the same hockey stick of adoption. Where by the time you thread it, it takes a while. But once the idea is threaded throughout society and culture, it really picks up.
Mm. Okay.
Never as fast as we want.
Right. Well, awareness is where it begins anyway, right? Awareness is where it begins.
Right. Right.
So let's talk about attachment to outcome, Joe. A very Buddhist philosophy of letting go of attachment, letting go of the end result. You write in the book, and I'm paraphrasing here, that even though it's often hailed as a key trait of leadership, facts show that rigid insistence on getting what we want can be a huge liability and detrimental, and is detrimental to clarity. Tell us how so, you know, because when we're goal setting, what are we told? Begin with the end in mind and work backwards. So how is that attachment to outcome detrimental to our clarity?
Well, I mean, for one thing, you know, things are always changing. So if we're so fixated on the plan we set, you know, a month ago or a year ago, and everything's changed on the ground, and we're not letting go of our plan, you can see, you know, it's pretty clear that we're wasting our time and energy, and we're investing in, and you know, we're throwing good energy after bad. There's a fascinating study done on this, what's called the sunk cost bias, in which you know, people were asked, you know, if you know, you bought a certain kind of a copy or a copy machine, and you know, you've invested that money, but then suddenly you hear about a more efficient one, you know, that may, you know, that's coming up now. Are you going to, you know, take the loss on the one you invested in and invest in the more, you know, efficient and productive one? And people who are, you know, living the normal life of staying focused on the goal, you know, have a tendency to sort of, you know, hold on to investment that they've already put in, and to not be open and nimble to be able to recognize, hey, you know, I need to make a course correction. And the capacity to let go, to sort of have that nimbleness or flexibility of mind, is a trainable capacity. And again, if we're leaning all in one direction, which is let's grab hold of the goal and not let go, you know, then we're not training this other capacity that gives us flexibility and allows us to respond to new conditions, to, you know, new information, to you know, things
right.
in the real world.
Right, right. We've only got a few minutes left here, but I wanted to touch on the state of flow. When I was reading this in the book, I thought about how few leaders and companies create space for a genuine state of flow. So I'm wondering, Elazar, what you have to say about flow and how leaders can encourage that. And is there a way that we can train ourselves to get into that state of flow?
Well, I mean, the good news is most all of us have experienced a state of flow on our own, whether it's in sports or in a hobby or, you know, something we're passionate about. We all can describe that. And the good news is, actually train. We can train for our mind-body to be in an optimal state. And we go through very specific practices of top-down and bottom-up of getting your body in the state where it can experience the flow. And what leaders can do is, one, understand that it is a state that conditions are favorable for. So you can create those conditions. Among them is psychological safety. Among them is engagement and inspiration with your people rather than motivating them by fear. Among them is the openness to errors and mistakes. So this whole creating these conditions, and then the understanding that the body is actually designed to be able to get into an optimal state, and that optimal state through breath work, through body postures, through visioning and changing your inner story. So there are very particular things we can do, but when you do them, you're really allowing yourself to become better and better trained in accessing your state of flow, which is actually a natural state for us.
Mm.
We just need to get back to it.
Right, right. And it's a great feeling when you're there, and you usually accomplish a lot. So last question then, Joe, for you is, Elazar just mentioned two of the four qualities of heart, engagement and inspiration. Resilience is another. I want to just ask you how empathy helps widen and deepen the circle of trust that you write about.
Absolutely. Empathy is so important. And often we think of it in sort of sentimental, sappy sentimental terms as being nice or sympathizing or even having kind of pity for others. But really, empathy is an incredibly vital information source about what is happening in the mind and body of other people. Right, because our main environment actually is the people that we're working with, whether they're in our company or they're people where, you know, our customers or partners or whatever. If we don't understand what's going on inside the other person's body, you know, what they're feeling, why they're feeling it, then we don't have a vital piece of information to be skillful with them and to communicate with them and to understand their behavior. And as a result, the potential for being off, misattuned, or for creating misunderstanding or difficult interaction is enormous. So part of the information that we really need to be sort of connected to our environment comes from empathy and reading. It's an art or a discipline to learn how to have accurate empathy, right? So, you know, we all have some sense of what other people are like because we have mirror neurons that read the body language and the facial expressions, but usually we filter that so much through our own experience that we can really very easily misunderstand what's happening in other people. And so bringing awareness that to this system, what kind of messages we're really getting from other people, clearing out our own projections, being able to recognize that that's my experience, it's not really necessarily what the other person is feeling, allows us to sort of fine-tune this very vital social skill that and then allows us to really create a sense of understanding and trust that is the basis for viable teamwork, for positive interactions, especially when things get difficult.
Right. Well, we're almost out of time now, so we didn't even get to my favorite exercise in the book, which I'll tell listeners is the Mandala of Boundless Leadership, where you get down on the floor with a large piece of paper and colored crayons and mess around. I love those kind of exercises. I want to ask a final thought here about, because we've talked a lot about leadership. Begins within, it begins with the self, it's an inside job. So I'm going to ask each of you, Elazar, we'll begin with you. What did you learn about your own self-leadership, or what was reinforced in you as you wrote this book together with Joe?
Well, I came to realize, back to your point about self-awareness, we only think we have so much of it, but I came to realize how much judgment or preconceived judgment I was using to be more efficient in my thinking, how much of a negativity bent I had because of the negativity bias, but also because of my life and conditioning. And through this journey, was able to really mitigate, if not eliminate, both those things, which has had a tremendous impact on my leadership.
That's great. And how about you, Joe?
Yeah, I would say something in a related vein, which is that, a lot of times, a lot of my efforts at making things work or having impact or whatever were sort of based on a deeper sense of insecurity. Am I going to, how are people perceiving me? How am I going to do? And kind of maybe a little tough self-criticism or disappointment in my limits at times. So being able to really, and that led to kind of wasting energy on overperforming. And also wasting energy on worrying too much.
Right.
So really learning how to sort of come back to find my own center and be okay with myself, strengths and weaknesses, and to move there from there more authentically, not coming from a place of feeling, I'm being judged or insecure about how I was going to do or come across, has really been a great relief to myself, but also I think it's helped improve my ability to really show up with others and be useful and helpful.
Well, job well done to both of you. The book is called Boundless Leadership, The Breakthrough Method to Realize Your Vision, Empower Others, and Ignite Positive Change. And I know listeners can find out much more about both of you and your work at boundlessleadershipbook.com, boundlessleadershipbook.com. Joe Loizzo and Elazar Aslan, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you both.
Absolutely. Thank you, Vicky. It's been great talking to you as well.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicky's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.